A smartass once accused me of being subtle. I decked him with a short right over the heart and an elbow in the trachea. The prison is the structure of bigotry. The prisoner's mouth, sentences of machine gun polemic, and the story is about as subtle as a turd in a punch bowl. You'll pardon all the hairy-chested masculine talk, incidentally, but I bought Mailer's new collection today, and as he puts it, it is as full of shit as a Yuletide turkey, yet the references to life being one big prize fight arena and all the studied vulgarity, they're catching. And since I want to truly become a writer of stature, like Algren and Mailer and Steinbeck and Hemingway and Irwin Shaw, it looks as though I'll have to cultivate all them crudities of sweaty body contact sports that prove my credentials for writing ballsy stories are the size of my genitalia. It ain't easy, troops. I find football a drag, basketball is dumb, baseball lost me around 1948 after the Indians copped the series, two pithecanthropoids in a ring getting their snouts turned into Smucker's jelly and their cerebrums mixmastered into Mrs. Grass's noodle soup turn me off. And I am not presumptuous enough to think I'm in competition with Jimmy Baldwin or even Mr. Mailer, whom I think I can cut most of the time. Even so, even taking this shocking inadequacy into account, the question of race boils my blood. So I'll let Norman work it out his way, and I'll talk about a battle without banners. When they first broke out of the machine shop, holding the guards before them, screwdrivers sharp and deadly against white cloth backs covering streaks of yellow, they made for the South Tower and took it without death. One of the hostage guards tried to break free, however, in the subsequent scuffle to liberate the machine gun from its gimbals and tracks, and Simon Rubin was forced to use the screwdriver on the man. They threw the body from the tower as an example to the remaining three hostages and had no further difficulties. In fact, the object lesson was so successful that it was the guards themselves that carried the cumbersome machine gun, with all its belts of ammunition, back down into the yard. The tower was an insecure defensive position, interlocked as it was with the other three towers and the sniping positions on the roofs of the main buildings. They had decided in advance to make it back down into the yard and there, with backs to the wall itself, to take their stand for as long as it took the second group to blow the gate. Construction on the new drainage system had been underway for only 2 days, and the great sheets of corrugated sheet metal, the sandbags, the picks and shovels, all were stacked under guard near the wall. They were forced to gun down the man on duty to get into the shelter of the piles of material, but it didn't matter either way if he lived or died, because they were going to take as many with them as they could, break out or not. Nigger Joe and Don Karpinski set up the big-barreled machine gun and braced its sides as well as fore and aft with sandbags, digging it in so the recoil would not affect its efficiency. Jip Williams, who had engineered the break, took up a solid rifleman's position, flat out on his belly with legs spread and toes pointed out, the machine rifle braced against right shoulder and the left elbow dug deep into the brown earth of the yard, supporting the tripod grip. His brown eyes, set deep into his black face, were roaming things as he covered the wide expanse of the yard, waiting for the first assault. It had to come. He was the readiest ever. Lou Steiner and the kid they called Chocolate made up the rest of the skirmish team, and they were busily unloading the homemade grenades and black powder bombs from the cotton batting of the insulated box when the first assault broke out of cover around the far wall of the administration building. They came as a wave of white-winged doves, the ivory of their uniforms blazing against the hard, cold light of the early morning. First came the sprayers, pocking the ground with little upbursts of dirt, and shredding the morning silence with the noise of their grease guns. Then a row of riflemen, and behind them, half a dozen long arms with grenades, if needed. "Away, they coming!" Jip Williams snapped over his shoulder. "Dig, babies!" And he got off the first burst of the defense into their middle. Three of the grease gunners went down, legs every which way and guns tossed off like refuse. Clattering and still chattering on automatic fire, pelting the wall with wasted lead. The second wave faltered an instant, and in that snatch of time, Nigger Joe fed the belts to Karpinski, who swung the big weapon back and forth in even arcs, cutting them down right across the bellies. None of the riflemen made it a fifth of the distance across the empty yard. One of them went down kicking, and Karpinski took him out on the next lowered arc. "I am?" Lou Steiner screamed, arching high to toss a black powder bomb. "Home free!" It hit and exploded 15 yards too short, but the effect was marvelous. The long arms caught up short and tried to turn. Bang, bang, and bang. Jip Williams grinned and murmured as he snapped off three sharp, short bursts, ending it for a trio of grenade carriers. And it was over that quickly, as the remaining grease gunners and three long arms fell, clambered, tripped, sprinted, raced back around the building. "We done that thing," Jip Williams rolled over on his back, aiming a thumb and finger pistol at his troops. "We sure enough, we done that thing." "Send those guards out of here," Chocolate nodded his head at the hostages. Jip agreed with a small movement of his massive head, and the three white-jacketed guards were shoved around the side of the enclosure, out into the open. For a moment they tensed, as though they expected to be shot down by the men in the tiny fort, but when no movement was made, they broke into a dead run across the yard, arms waving, yelling to their compatriots that they were coming through. The first burst of machine gun fire came from the North Tower, and took one of them in mid-stride, making him miss his footing, leap, and plunge in a half-somersault to crash finally onto the ground, sliding a foot and a half on the side of his face. The second burst cut down his partners. They tumbled, almost into a loving embrace, piled atop one another. Chocolate expelled breath through dry lips and asked, "Who's got the cigarettes?" Simon Reuben tossed him the pack, and for a while, they just lay there, smoking, alert, watching the bodies of the dead white guards who had been shot by their own men. "Well," Jip Williams commented philosophically after a time, "everybody knows a white cat gets around niggers is gonna get contaminated. They just couldn't be trust, man. Dirty. Dirty." "And kikes," Lou Steiner added. "Ding, ding." They settled down for the long wait till the second group could blow the wall. They watched the shadows of the sun slither across the yard. Nothing moved. Warm and nice. Waiting. Quiet, too. "How long you been in this prison?" Chocolate asked Simon Reuben. There was no answer for the space of time it took Reuben to draw in on the butt and expel smoke through his nostrils. Then his long, horsey face drew down, character lines in the bony cheeks and around the deep-set eyes mapping new expressions. "As far back as I can remember," he replied carefully, thinking about it. "I suppose all of my life." Chocolate nodded lightly, turning back to the empty yard with a thin whistle of nervousness. Something should happen. They all wanted it. "When the hell they gonna blow that gate?" Nigger Joe murmured. He had been biting the inside of his full lower lip, chewing, biting again. "I thought they was gonna blow it soon's we got a position here. What the hell they doing back in there?" Jip Williams motioned him to silence. "Quiet. Will you? They'll get on it. You take it easy." "I'm really scared," Don Karpinski added a footnote. "It It's like waiting for them to come and kill you. My old man told me about that at Belsen, how they came around and just looked at you, didn't say a word, just walked up and down, gauging you, looking to see if there was meat on you. And then later, boy, oh boy, later they came back and didn't have any trouble picking you out, just walked up and down again, pointing, that one, and...
Can it? Jip Williams hushed him.
Boy, you sure can't talk.
He was silent a second, scrutinizing the young man, too young to need a shave every day, but old enough to be here behind the wall with them. Then,
what you in for, boy?
Don Karpinski looked startled, his face rearranging itself to make explanations, excuses, reading itself for extenuating circumstances, amelioration.
I hurt some people.
Jip Williams turned toward him more completely, yet kept a corner of his eye on the empty yard where the bodies remained crumpled.
You what? You did what? I hurt some people with a bomb. See, I made this bomb, and when I tossed it, I didn't know there was any...
Whoa back, boy! Jip Williams pulled the young man's race-through dialogue to a halt. Go on back a bit. You made a what? A bomb? Karpinski nodded dumbly. It was obvious he had never thought he would be censured here.
Now what in the hell you do that for, boy?
Don Karpinski turned to the belts of long slugs neatly folded over themselves, ready for the maw of the machine gun. He would not, or could not, answer. Simon Rubin spoke up. He had been listening to the interchange, but had decided to let the young Karpinski handle his own explanations. But now it needed ending, and since the young man had confided in him one rainy night in their cell, he felt the privileged communication might best be put to use here.
Jip!
He called the big black man's attention away from Karpinski. It served to halt the next words from Jip Williams' mouth.
He bombed a church, Jip. Some little town in Iowa. The minister was apparently some kind of a monster, got the local male white Protestants convinced Jews ate Goyish children for Passover. They made it hell on the kid and his family. He was a chemistry bug, made a bomb, and tossed it. Killed 6 people. They threw him in here.
Jip Williams seemed about to say something, merely clucked his tongue, and rolled over once more into a firing position. The only sound in the enclosure was the metallic sliding of the machine rifle's bolt as Jip Williams made unnecessary checks. Lou Steiner was asleep against the wall, his back propped outward by a sandbag, a black powder bomb in each hand, as though in that instant of snapping awake he might reflexively hurl one of the spheroids more accurately, more powerfully than he had in combat.
What do you think, Jip?
Chocolate asked.
You think they're going to try and take us in daylight, or wait till tonight?
He was as young as Don Karpinski, somewhere under 20, but a reddish, ragged scar that split down his left cheek to the corner of his mouth made him seem, somehow, older, more experienced, more capable of violence than the boy who had bombed the small Iowa church. Jip Williams rose up on an elbow, gaining a better field of vision across the yard. He talked as much to himself as to Chocolate.
I don't know. Might be they'd be careful about waiting till dark. That's a good time for us as much as them. And when the other boys make the move to blow the gate, the dock will be on our side. We can shoot out them searchlights.
He chuckled, lightly, almost naively.
What's so funny?
Nigger Joe asked, then turned as Simon Rubin asked,
Hey, Joe, I got a crick in my back here. Want to rub it out for me?
Nigger Joe acknowledged the request and slid across the dirt to Rubin, who turned his back, indicating the sore area. The Negro began thumbing it smooth with practiced hands, repeating,
Jip, what's so funny?
Jip Williams's ruggedly handsome face went into a softer stage.
I remember the night they came for us. The caravan, about 15-20 cars, came on down to Little Town, all of them with the hoods, looking for the one who'd grabbed a feel off the druggist's wife. Man, they were sure pretty, all of them real black against the sky, just them white hoods showing them off like perfect targets. There's about 10 of us, see? About 10 all laid out like I am now, out there on a little hill in the tall grass, watching them cars move on down. Show-offs, that's what they was. Show-offs, or they wouldn't have sat up on the backs of them convertibles, where we could see them so plain. No lights on the cars, all silent, but the white hoods as plain as moonlight. We got about 13 or 14 of them cats before they figured they'd been ruined. I was just thinking about it now, thinking about them searchlights when they come on. Those white uniforms gonna be might fine to shoot at soon's it gets dark.
Then, without a break in meter, his tone became frenzied, annoyed. When the hell are they gonna blow that goddamn gate? As if in reply, a long, strident burst from a grease gun sprayed from the roof of the administration building, pocked the wall behind them, chewing out irregular niches in the brick. They were spattered with brick chips and mortar, dirt and whizzing bits of stone. Lou Steiner came rigidly awake, grasped the situation, and ducked in a dummy-up cover, imitating the other five defenders. They were huddled over that way when they heard the whispering, chalking whir of helicopter rotors chewing the air.
"They're coming over the wall in a copter!" Don Karpinski shrieked.
Jip Williams turned over, elevating the machine rifle, bracing it on an upright sheet of corrugated metal.
"Lou, get set, them bombs, they coming over, Lou!"
But Steiner was lost in fear. It was silence he heard, rather than the commanding voice of Jip Williams. His buttocks stared out where his face should have been, and Jip Williams cursed tightly, eyes directed at the wall, scanning, tracking back and forth for the first sight of the guard helicopter, coming with the tear gas or the thermite or a 10-second shrapnel canister.
"Joe, do something about him. You, Joe!"
Nigger Joe slid across the ground, grasped Lou Steiner by the hair, and jerked him out of the snail-like fetal position he had assumed. Steiner still clutched the black smoke bombs, one in either fist, like thick, burnt rolls snatched from an oven. The colored man was unconcerned with niceties. He slapped Steiner heavily, the sound a counterpoint to the copter's rising comments. Lou Steiner did not want to come back from wherever he had gone to find peace and security, but the black man's palm would not be ignored. He bounced the work-pinkened flesh off Steiner's cheeks until the milky blue of sight unseen had faded, and Steiner was back with them.
"Them bombs, Lou," Nigger Joe said, softly, with great kindness. "They coming over the wall right here behind us."
Steiner's defection was already forgotten. No more was said as Steiner rolled over, ready to meet the helicopter with his bombs. Chocolate and Don Karpinski stayed with the fixed machine gun, prepared for a rear guard attack in the face of the aerial threat. Nigger Joe and Simon Rubin lay on their backs, rifles pointed at the sky. The whirlybird came over the wall 50 feet down the line, and Jip Williams quickly readjusted himself for its approach. The machine was perhaps 20 feet over their heads and came churning toward them rapidly, as though intent on low-level strafing. Jip Williams loosed his first burst before the others, and it missed the mark by 2 feet. The helicopter came on rapidly, steadily. The six men lay staring at it, readying themselves, trying at the same time to find places for their naked bodies in the earth. When it was almost directly overhead, Lou Steiner rose to a kneeling position and hurled first one black powder bomb, then the other, with tremendous force. The first bomb went straight, directly up into the air, passed over the cockpit of the machine, and tumbled back, wobbling, to hit the top of the wall, bounce, and explode on the other side. The reverberation could be felt in the wall and the ground, but no rifts appeared in the brick. The second bomb crashed into the side of the machine, and a deafening roar split up the even susurration of the copter's rotors. The machine tottered on its course, slipped sidewise, and lost minor altitude, but was compensated, began to climb, and just as it hurled itself away in a slanting curve, a projectile tumbled dizzily, end over end, from the machine. Then the copter was gone, and they watched the projectile falling straight for them. Jip Williams began screaming, "Fire! Fire! Hit it! Hit it! Hit it! Hit it! Hit it! Hit it! Hit it!" And they all poured flame into the sky, missing the tear gas bomb as it fell a few yards from their enclosure, exploded, and sent rolling clouds of tear gas straight toward them. The vapors struck, and they began to feel the sting of the chemicals, and their eyes went blood red in a moment, and Don Karpinski fell on his side, clutching his face, crying like an infant. Lou Steiner grabbed up another bomb from somewhere and hurled it at the empty yard, a motion of wanton fury and impotence that no one saw, himself most of all. Jip Williams refused to cry. He dug his broad face deep into the dirt and enjoyed the cool feel of pain from gravel and sod, but the stinging was terrible, and his grunts of feeling were strangely intermingled. The others recoiled, tried to protect themselves, and knew the guards would attack in this moment. They could hear them coming, rebel yells of victory and bloodlust strung out rustily in the air. And over the battle cries, the malicious tattle of the machine gun as chocolate sprayed the yard in steady back-and-forth sweeps. Blind to everything, tears running out of his burning eyes, knowing only that he had the power to cut them down, the young man with the livid scar continued his barrage, building a wall of death the guards in their white uniforms could not penetrate. And after a while, when the belts were exhausted and the guards had gone back to cover, when the gas had blown away, stringers of mist on a late afternoon breeze some god had sent to prolong their passion, they all lay back with eyes crimson and streaming, knowing it had to be over soon, and hoping the second group would finally, please, dear Lord, blow that frigging gate. "Man, how long? How long?" Nigger Joe spoke to the advancing dusk. "How long this gonna go on? It seems like I've been living off misery all my life. You'd think it ends sometime, not just keep going on and on and on." Simon Rubin sat up and looked at him, and there was compassion in his lean, ascetic face. "How many times I got a lead stepping down into the gutter for some fake cat? How many times I gotta be called boy? And when am I gonna get some memories I want to put away to think back on another time?" His eyes were lost in the twilight, set deep under bony eyebrow ridges, but his fierce voice was all around them, very soft but compelling. "Even in here, they making me be something I ain't. Even in here, I'm trying to get away, get some life, what's left to me. And they got me down with my face in the dirt. They don't know. Man, they never know. I can remember every one of them cats, making jokes, poking fun, saying things. A man's got to have pride. That's what matters, just as goddamn pride. They can have all the rest of it. Just give me the pride. And when they come round taking that too, then you got to raise up and split some son of a bitch's head with a shovel." Simon Rubin's voice came sliding in on the semi-darkness, a cool, soft fabric covering tiny sounds of crickets and metal clanking on metal from somewhere out there. "I know how you feel, Joe. There are a lot of us in that kind of ghetto. Only for some of us, it gets worse, even when it gets better. You knew your kind of hate, but it was different for me." Jip Williams snorted in disgust. "Shit, man.
When you Jewish cats gonna come off that kick? When you gonna stop lying on yourself, man, that you've been persecuted so you know how a black man feels? Jesus. You Jewish own most of the tenements up in Harlem. You as bad as any of the rest of them cats.
He turned away in suppressed fury, turning his anger on the machine rifle, whose bolt he snapped back twice quickly. Simon Reuben began speaking again as though by the continuing stream of words he could negate what Jip Williams had said.
I wanted to get into dental college, but they had a quota on Jews. I didn't have the money or the name to be in that quota, so I went out for veterinary medicine. I got set back and set back so many times, I finally said to hell with it, and I changed my name and had my nose fixed, and then I married a Gentile. It even worked for a while.
He smiled thinly, remembering out of his not very Semitic face.
And then one night we had a fight about something, I don't remember what, and we went to bed angry, and in the middle of the night I turned to her and we started to make love. And when she was ready, she began saying over and over in my ear, "Now, you dirty kike. Now, you dirty kike."
Simon Reuben buried his face in his hands. Don Karpinski asked,
"Simon? So I know how you feel, Joe,"
Simon finished.
"I hated myself more than she could ever hate me. And when they sent me here for her, because of her, what I did to her, I gave them my name the way I came into the world with it. So I know, Joe, believe me, I know."
Nigger Joe started to turn away, his thoughts turned inward. He paused and looked directly at Simon Reuben.
"I'm sorry you feel bad, Simon," he lamented. "It's just, I've been in chains 400 years, and all that clanking makes me here not so good. I'm sorry you got troubles, man."
And their contest of agonies, their cataloging of misery, their one-up of sorrow was cut short as the loudspeaker blared from across the yard from the administration building.
"Hey! Hey over there!"
It was the main loudspeaker mounted on the administration building where the guards were waiting to come for them, holding out, it was now obvious, until their nerves were raw.
"Hey, Simon, Lou, all the rest of you, this is David. Do you hear me? Can you hear me, all of you?"
Jip Williams fired off a long flaming burst, and they could hear the tinkle and shatter of window glass when it hit. It was an answer of sorts.
"Listen, we can't blow the gate. We just can't do it, you guys."
Chocolate looked at his companions.
"Hey, that's David, the one who was with the second group. What's he doing in there with them?"
Jip Williams motioned him to silence. They listened.
"They've got the gate staked out. Listen, you men, they have it fixed, so we can't get at it, Simon. Lou Steiner, all of you, Jip Williams, listen. They said they won't punish us if we go back to our cells. They said they won't demand payment. We can go right on like we were before. It's better this way. It isn't so bad. We know what we can do. We know what they won't let us do. Simon, Jip, come on back. Come on back and they won't make any trouble for us. We can go on the way we were before. Don't rock the boat, you guys! Don't rock the boat!"
Jip Williams rose to both knees, somehow manhandling the heavy machine rifle against his chest, and he screamed at the top of his voice, throwing his head back so his very white teeth stood out like a necklace of sparkling gems in his mouth.
"Sell out, bastards!"
And he fired. Without taking his finger from the trigger, he fired and the flames and heat and steel and anguish went cascading across the yard, hitting unreceptive stone and gravel, and occasionally, one of the already dead would leap as a slug tore its cold flesh. Finally, when he had made it clear what their answer was to be, he fell exhausted behind the sandbags, where he would die. In that instant of minor silence, Simon Reuben said, "I'm going back." And he got up and walked across the yard, his head down, his hands locked behind his head. Don Karpinski began to cry then, and chocolate slid across to him, trying by his nearness to stop the fear and the fury of being too brave to live, too cowardly to die without tears. No one behind the barricade moved to shoot Simon Reuben. There was no point to it, no anger at him, only pity and deep revulsion. And the guards in their immaculate white did not shoot him. Back in their world, he was infinitely more valuable as a symbol, a broken image for the others who might try to free themselves another time. They would point to him and say, "See, Simon Reuben, he tried to rock the boat, and see what he's like?" Behind the barricade, Nigger Joe turned to Lou Steiner and the crying kid who had not fled with Simon Reuben. "There, that's how much your people understand." He condemned them all. And Lou Steiner said, "There were half a dozen of your boys in that second group, Joe. My back aches again. You feel like doing that thing?" Nigger Joe chuckled lackadaisically, slid over, and began thumbing Lou Steiner's back. They were like that, waiting, when the final assault began. The high, keening whine of a mortar shell came at them like the Doppler of a train passing on a track, and it landed far down at the end where chocolate caught it full and split up like a ripe, dark pod. He was dead even as it struck, and the other four fell in a heap to protect themselves from screaming shrapnel. When the ground had ceased to tremble and they could see the world again, they tried not to look toward the end of the barricade where a brown leg and a torn bit of cloth showed from under the heap of rubble, from under the fallen sheets of metal. They tried not to look and succeeded, but Jip Williams's face was now incapable of even that half-bitter, knowing smile he had offered before. Another whining shell came across, struck the wall above them, and exploded violently, with Lou Steiner's howl of pain matching it on a lower level. The shard of twisted metal had caught him in the neck, ripping through and leaving him with a deep furrow, welling out wetly, black-red down his shirt and over the hand he raised to staunch the flow. Nigger Joe tore his shirt down the front and made a crude bandage. "It ain't bad, Lou. Here, hold this on if you can." The four of them turned back to see the first wave of white-uniformed guards breaking from the cover of the administration building and another group from around the end of the laundry. They came on like a wide-angled V with a long-arm grenade hurler at the point. Jip Williams turned loose with the machine rifle and swept the first attackers. They fell, but one of them got off a grenade and it sailed almost gracefully, a balloon of hard stuff, over and over into the enclosure. The earth split up and deafened them, and great chunks of steel and stone cascaded about them. It was enough to ruin the machine gun and send Don Karpinski tumbling over backward, his body saturated with tiny bits of steel and sand. He lay sprawled backward, eyes open at the sky of free darkening blue, over the wall he would never climb. The huddled there, the three of them left, Jip Williams, Nigger Joe, and Lou Steiner, still clutching the bloody rag to his neck. The guards, in their white uniforms, would not let them go back to the cells. They knew the ones who were weak enough to keep from rocking the boat, and they knew the ones who had to be destroyed. These three were the last of the ones who had sought their freedom and their pride. They would be killed where they lay, when the ammunition had run out and all the strength was sapped from them, not only by the fighting, but by the ones who had betrayed them, the ones who had said it was better not to make trouble. And as the waves of faceless, soulless attackers streamed toward them across the dead-piled yard, no more intent on the particular men behind the barricade than they would have been about any other vermin who threatened them, Jip Williams said it all for all three of them, and for the few strong ones who had found peace, if not pride.
We all of us down in the dark. Someday. Maybe. Someday.
Then he managed, somehow, to get the machine rifle steadied, and he fired into the midst of them, screaming and running with their immaculate white uniforms, the badges of purity and cleanliness. But there were just too many of them. There were always just too many of them. New York City, 1961.